In the control room, Gordon said, "He said what?" "They can't come back." "Absolutely not." Bob was firm. "But they have to come back," David Stern said. "You have to let them."
"No, I don't," Kramer said.
"But,
John," Kramer said, turning to Gordon, "has he seen Wellesley?"
"Who's Wellesley?"
"Wellesley's a cat," Gordon said.
"Wellesley's split," Kramer said to Stern. "He was one of the first test animals, and he's very badly split."
"Split?" Kramer turned to Gordon.
"Haven't you told him anything?"
"Of course I told him," Gordon said to Stern. "Split means he had very severe transcription errors. But that happened years ago, Diane, back when we also had problems with the computers as well."
"Show him, and then see if he's still so eager to bring his friends back."
At the consoles, one of the technicians said, "We've got a field, Buck." They crowded around the monitor, looking at the undulating wave.
"How long before they come back?" Stern said.
"Judging from this signal, about an hour."
"Can you tell how many?" Gordon said.
"Not yet, but it's more than one."
They turned to Kramer.
"Sorry," she said. "No shields, nobody comes back. That's final."
1 hour, 1 minute. Kate stepped through the trap door. Firelight was coming in from an opening to her left. She saw a door directly ahead. Behind her was a set of stairs going steeply upward. Chris peered over the edge of the trap door and pointed to the firelight.
"I think we know why they never found the door to this passage."
"Why?"
"It's behind the fireplace."
She realized he was right. This narrow space was one of the secret passages of La Roque. Kate moved forward and found herself staring out from the back wall of the fireplace in the great hall. Through the leaping flames, she saw Oliver's high table where his knights were sitting and eating, their backs to her. She was about to continue to the door when Sir Guy glanced back at the fire. His eyes met hers and he shouted,
"My lord!"
He pushed back from the table and drew his sword. Kate ran to the door, tugged at it, but it was locked or stuck shut. She turned back to the narrow stairs. Sir Guy plunged through the fire. Apparently he didn't see Chris, because she heard him coming up the stairs. She ran. At the top of the stairs, 30 feet above the ground, was a narrow platform. It was precarious, but from her climbing it didn't bother her. But it bothered Sir Guy. He had a desperate look, but his discomfort seemed to make him angrier. The platform faced a wooden door with a round view hole. The stairs had clearly been built to lead to this hole. An observer could look down on the great hall. Kate pushed at the door, but instead of opening, the entire rectangle fell through, dropping onto the great hall floor below, and she half fell through after it. She was up high among the heavy wooden beams of the open ceiling. She looked down at the tables 30 feet below her. Directly ahead was the enormous central rafter running the length of the hall. This beam was crisscrossed with horizontal rafters. Kate stepped out onto the central beam. Everyone below was looking up. They gasped when they saw her. She heard Oliver cry loudly,
"St. George and damnation! The assistant! We're betrayed! The Magister!"
He pounded the table and stood, glaring up at her. She said,
"Chris, find the professor."
She heard a crackle.
"Kay."
Kate moved quickly down the center rafter. Guy took a hesitant step, found his balance, and came directly for her, moving rapidly. Chris came up through the trap door. He looked through the fire and saw that everybody in the room was staring up at the ceiling. He knew Kate was up there, but there was nothing he could do for her. He went to the door and slammed his full weight against it. The door creaked and swung wide. He stepped out into the inner courtyard of La Roque. Soldiers were running everywhere. Amid the chaos, no one paid any attention to him. He said,
"Andre, are you there?"
"Yes."
"Where are you?"
"The arsenal."
"Where is that?"
There were 2 dozen animals in cages in the laboratory. Gordon led him to one, where he saw a small, curled-up bundle of fur, pale gray in color.
"This is Wellesley," Gordon said.
Stern leaned closer, but Gordon put his hand on his chest.
"Not too close."
The cat's eye opened. With a furious hiss, the cat flung itself against the bars, mouth wide, teeth bared.
It banged against the bars relentlessly without pause, hissing, snarling. Stern stared in horror. The animal's face was hideously distorted. One side appeared normal, but the other side was distinctly lower, the eye, the nostril, everything lower, with a line down the center of the face dividing the halves. That was why they called it Split, he thought. But worse was the far side of the face. Behind the distorted ear, there was a third eye, and beneath that, a curve of teeth poked out from the fur, though there was no mouth. Transcription errors. He now understood what that meant. The cat banged again and again. Gordon said,
"He'll do that until we leave."
"Then we better leave." They walked in silence. Then Gordon said,
"It's not just what you can see. There are mental changes, too. That was the first noticeable change in the person who was Split."
"This is the person you were telling me about? The one who stayed back?"
"Yes. Deckard. Rob Deckard. He was one of our Marines."
"What kind of mental changes?"
"Originally, Rob was a cheerful guy, but Rob turned mean. Really mean. He beat the hell out of the gate guard here, because the guard took too long checking his ID."
Back in the control room, they found Kramer staring at the field fluctuations. They were coming more strongly now, and the technicians were saying that at least three were coming back, and maybe four or five. It was clear Kramer was torn. She wanted to see the students come back.
"I still think the computer is wrong and the panels will hold," Gordon said. "We certainly can fill the tanks now and see if they hold."
Kramer nodded. "Yes, we can do that. But even if they fill without breaking, we can't be certain they won't blow out later in the middle of the transit. And that would be a disaster." Stern shifted in his seat. He felt suddenly uneasy. Something was tickling the back of his mind. When Kramer said, "blowout," he saw automobiles in his mind, a big nail in the road and a tire driving over it. Blowout. The water tanks would blow out. The tires would blow out. What was it about blowouts? Stern sighed. "How much time left?" The technician said, 54 minutes and counting. 54 minutes. To Kate's astonishment, she heard applause from the floor below, as if this was a circus act. She ran to the center of the ceiling. She was standing in the middle of the open roof, holding onto a thick vertical strut. The strut was about 2 feet in diameter, and it had supporting braces. These braces were so low that if Sergei intended to get to her, he would have to crouch down as he made his way around the strut. As she crouched to get around it, her hand brushed her dagger. She'd forgotten she had it. She drew it out now. Guy saw her and laughed. His laughter was picked up by the watching crowd. She watched him come toward her. It was all going to be timing, she thought. Sergei crouched down. His hand was wrapped around the wood, his sword in his right hand temporarily pressed against the strut. She ran forward and stabbed his hand with the dagger, pinning it to the strut. Then she swung around to the opposite side of the strut and kicked his feet off the central beam. Guy fell into space, dangling from his pinned hand. He clenched his teeth but didn't make a sound. Jesus, these guys were tough. He tried to get back up on the beam, but by then she had swung back to her original position on the other side of the beam. His eyes met hers. He knew what she was going to do.
"Rot in hell," he snarled.
"You first," she said. She pulled her dagger free from the wood. Guy slammed onto a table, sending crockery flying. He didn't move. Oliver was pointing up at Kate and shouting, "Kill him! Kill him!" Archers ran for weapons. Oliver stomped out of the hall, taking several soldiers with him. She saw a second door in the other wall, matching the first, and she hit it hard, knocking it open, and crawled out of the hall into darkness. It was a very tight space. She banged her head against the ceiling, and she realized that this was the north end of the great hall, which meant it was freestanding and was not against the castle wall. Therefore, she pushed upward at the roof. A section gave way. She stepped out onto the roof and from there climbed up onto the ramparts of the inner wall. From here she could see the siege was fully underway. Cannon on the battlements were being loaded with metal arrows, with Dakir striding back and forth, barking instructions. She turned away, pressed her ear, and said, "Chris?" Dakir spun, his hand clapped over his ear. Suddenly he was turning, looking everywhere along the length of the battlements and down into the courtyards. It was Dakir. And then Dakir saw her. Kate ran. Chris said, "Kate, I'm down here." Flaming arrows were slashing down all over the courtyard. He waved to her up on the wall. Then he turned away, watching Oliver and four soldiers leading the professor and Marek away, heading to a far door in the castle wall. The soldiers pushed them forward at sword point.
"Kate, I see them."
"Where?"
"Going into that corner door."
He started to follow, realized he needed a weapon. Just a few feet away, a burning arrow struck a soldier in the back. Chris bent over, took the man's sword.
"Chris."
A man's voice in his earpiece, an unfamiliar voice.
"Chris, over here."
Then he saw through the flames a dark figure staring at him from across the courtyard. It was Robert Dakir.
"Chris, do you know what I want?"
And then Dakir started walking toward him. And suddenly a door behind the great hall burst open, and a knight came out, in full armor except for his helmet, bellowing,
"For God and Archpriest Arno!"
He recognized the handsome knight, Raimondo. Dozens of soldiers in green and black were pouring out into the courtyard, engaging Oliver's troops in a pitched battle. Suddenly Arno grabbed Chris by the throat, holding his sword high.
"Oliver! Where is Oliver?"
Chris pointed to the far door.
"Show me!"
He went with Arno across the courtyard, through the door. Following stairs spiraling downward, they came to a series of underground chambers. Chris heard voices up ahead. One of them sounded like the professor. In the control room, Stern watched as heavy hoses were dragged over to the first of the empty shield tanks. Men climbed up ladders and adjusted the nozzles.
"I think this is best," Gordon said. "At least we'll..."
Stern jumped to his feet.
"No," he said. "Don't do it."
"What?"
"Don't fill the tanks. Tell them to stop. No water whatsoever in the tank. Not a drop."
Gordon gave an order on the radio.
"Why not?"
"Because it'll screw up the glue."
"The glue?"
"I know how to strengthen them."
Gordon turned to the technicians.
"How much time?"
35 minutes.
"David, there isn't time."
"Yes, there is. There's enough time if we go like hell."
Kate came into the central courtyard where she had last seen Chris, but Chris was gone.
"Chris!"
She heard no answer, and he had the ceramic, she thought. She saw Raimondo, who gave her a little nod and a wave, and then he shuddered. She saw him turn, bleeding from his side. There was a man standing behind him, hacking repeatedly with his sword, cutting Raimondo. Every cut was deep enough to wound, but not to kill. Raimondo fell backward, and now the man was slashing Raimondo's face. The attacker's face was hidden by flames, but she heard him say,
"Bastard, bastard, bastard," with each blow.
Slowly, she realized he was speaking English. The attacker was Dakir. In the dungeon, Chris followed Arno. They could see into the next chamber, which was dominated by a large pit in the ground. Above the pit, a heavy metal cage hung from a chain. The professor was standing inside the bars, his face expressionless as the cage was lowered by two soldiers who turned a winch crank. Marek had been pushed against the far wall, his hands tied. Lord Oliver stood at the side of the pit. Oliver was smiling.
"I've made you my promise, Magister, and I will keep it."
To the soldiers at the winch, he said,
"Slower, slower."
Staring at Oliver, Arno growled like an angry dog and drew his sword. He turned back to Chris and whispered,
"I shall take Oliver. You may have the others."
Chris thought, the others? There were four soldiers in the room, but he had no time to protest, for Arno was running forward, shouting,
"Oliver!"
In a moment, the battle was joined. Chris was now running toward the soldiers at the winch. The soldiers beside Marek had raised their swords. Oliver and Arno fought bitterly. Everything was happening fast now. Marek tripped one of the soldiers near him and stabbed him with a knife so small Chris couldn't see it. The other soldier turned back to face Marek, and Marek kicked him hard so that he staggered back against the winch, knocking the men away. The winch began to clank down rapidly. There was a ratchet mechanism of some kind, so it turned noisily. Chris saw the professor's cage descend below ground level, disappearing into the pit. By then, Chris had reached the first of the soldiers, whose back was to him. The man started to turn, and Chris swung. The man fell. Now there were only two soldiers. Marek, his wrists still tied, was backing away from one, ducking the hissing blade. The second soldier stood by the winch. Chris swung. The man parried easily. Then Marek, backing in a circle, banged against the soldier, who turned momentarily. Marek shouted, "Now!" and Chris stabbed with the sword. The man collapsed. The winch was still turning. Chris grabbed it, then jumped away as the fourth soldier's sword came down with a clang. Chris backed away.
Marek was holding his bound wrists out to Chris. Marek was shouting, "Do it!" So Chris swung, the rope snapped, and then the fourth soldier was on him. Chris was cut on the forearm as he backed away. He realized he was in trouble when suddenly his attacker looked down in horror. The soldier toppled, and Chris saw Marek holding the blade. Chris ran for the winch. The cage was deep in the oily water. The professor's head was barely above the surface. Marek came over, and together they began to crank the cage back up. "How much time is left?" Marek looked at his counter. 26 minutes. Meanwhile, Arnaud and Oliver fought on. The cage rose dripping into the air. The professor smiled at Chris.
"I thought you'd be in time."
Chris went to open the cage, but he saw that it was locked. There was a heavy iron padlock the size of a man's fist. "Where's the key?" Chris said, turning to Marek.
"I don't know."
"Professor?" Johnston shook his head. Andre looked around the dungeon. Chris went to the nearest dead soldier and began searching the body. In the control room, Stern watched as the technicians dipped the pale rubber membrane into a bucket of adhesive and then placed it inside the mouth of the glass shield. Then they attached a compressed air hose. For a moment, it was possible to see that it was a weather balloon, but then it expanded, the rubber becoming translucent, assuming the shape of the glass shield until it reached every corner of the container. Then technicians capped it, clicked a stopwatch, and waited while the adhesive hardened.
Stern said, "How much time?"
21 minutes to go.
He pointed to the balloons.
"It's homely, but it works."
Stern shook his head. "It was staring me in the face for the last hour."
"What was?"
"Blowouts," he said.
"I kept thinking, what are we trying to avoid here? And the answer is blowouts. Blowouts are so rare because the new tires have an inner membrane that's self-sealing. I kept wondering why this rare thing was on my mind, and then I realized that was the whole point. There was a way to make a membrane here, too."
Now they were waiting for the glue to harden. Gordon glanced at his watch.
3 more minutes.
"And then how long to fill each tank?"
6 minutes. But we can do 2 tanks at a time."
Kramer sighed. 18 minutes, cutting it close."
"We'll make it,"
Gordon said. Kramer looked back at the monitor. "Why are the spikes getting smaller?" Gordon came over to look. He frowned.
"Something must have gone wrong back there, and whatever it is, it's changed the probability that they will return."
15 minutes, 2 seconds. Chris was sweating. He'd spent frantic minutes going through the maroon and gray uniforms of the two dead soldiers trying to find the key. But Chris didn't find it. Swearing, he got to his feet. Across the dungeon, Arnaud was still fighting with Oliver. Marek was searching the dark corners of the dungeon. Chris went over to the professor. Chris could almost hear the clock ticking in his head. "I'm sorry, I'm really sorry." As always, the professor was unruffled.
"I've been thinking, Chris. Oliver locked me in himself. I think he kept the key."
Across the room, Arnaud drove Oliver back to the edge of the pit. There, Oliver leaned on the railing, too exhausted to continue.
"Mercy! I beg mercy!"
But Arnaud slowly pressed harder with the sword. "My lord Arnaud," Marek said, stepping forward, "we need the key to the cage."
"Eh? Key to the cage?"
Gasping, Oliver smiled. Arnaud jabbed with the sword.
"Tell us." "Never."
If you tell us, Arno said, I shall spare your life.
Certes?
I am no cunning, two-faced Englishman. Give us the key and I swear I shall not kill you.
Very well.
He threw away his sword, reached under his rope, and brought out a heavy iron key. Marek took it. Oliver turned back to Arno.
So, are you a man of your word?
Indeed, Arno said. I shall not kill you.
He moved forward swiftly and clasped Oliver's knees.
I shall bathe you.
And he flipped Oliver bodily over the rail into the pit below. Oliver landed with a splash. He came up sputtering. Cursing, he treaded water.
Arno said, Do you swim well?
Very well, you son of a French pig.
Good.
Then your bath will take some time.
With a parting nod to Chris and Marek, he said,
I am in your debt. May God grant you mercy.
And then he ran quickly away to rejoin the battle. Marek unlocked the cage. The professor stepped out.
Time?
11 minutes, Marek said. They hurried out of the dungeon. Behind them they heard Oliver splashing in the water.
Arno!
Oliver cried, his voice echoing from the dark stone walls.
Arno!
9 minutes, 4 seconds. In the control room they stared at the monitor. The peaks had nearly vanished.
Whatever the problem is back there,
Gordon said,
they still have it.
Through the flames that leapt up in the central courtyard, Kate saw the professor and the others come out of a doorway. She ran to join them. Kate said to Chris, Do you have the ceramic?
Yes, I have it.
He brought it out of his pocket, turned it to press the button. There's not enough space. You need 2 meters on all sides, remember?
You won't find that anywhere in this courtyard, Marek said.
That's right, the professor said. We have to go out to the next courtyard.
Kate looked ahead. The gatehouse leading to the outer courtyard was 40 yards away. It didn't look as if the gate was guarded. The soldiers had all abandoned it to fight the intruders.
How much time?
5 minutes.
Okay, the professor said. Let's get moving.
They moved at a trot, sidestepping flames and battling soldiers. The professor and Kate were in the lead. Marek, wincing with the pain in his leg, followed behind. And Chris, worried about Marek, brought up the rear. They ran through the gate and entered the middle courtyard.
Oh, no, Kate said.
All of Oliver's soldiers were garrisoned in the middle court.
No room here, the professor said. We'll have to go through the next gate, outside the castle.
Outside, Kate said. We'll never even get across this courtyard. Marek came hobbling up.
Where's Chris?
They looked back into the central courtyard. They didn't see him anywhere. Chris had been following Marek when suddenly he was slammed against a wall. He heard a voice say in perfect English,
Not you, pal. You stay here.
And he felt the point of a sword jabbed in his back. He turned to see Robert Dekeer. Chris saw with alarm that they were just outside the arsenal. Dekeer didn't seem to care. He smiled. In fact, none of you bastards are going anywhere.
Why is that?
Because you have their marker, pal.
No, I don't.
I can hear your transmissions, remember? Give it to me. He shoved Chris into the arsenal. It was empty. All around him were stacked bags of gunpowder. The basins where the soldiers had been grinding still lay on the floor.
Your goddamn professor, Dekeer said, seeing the bowls. Think you know so much. Give it to me.
Chris fumbled under his doublet, reaching for his pouch. Dekeer snapped his fingers impatiently.
Come on. Come on, hurry up. You guys are just like Doniger.
You know what Doniger said?
Don't worry, Rob. We're making new technology that will fix you up.
But he didn't make any new technology. He never intended to. He was just lying the way he always does. My goddamn face. He touched the scar that ran down the center.
It hurts all the time. And my insides are screwed up. Hurts.
Chris felt his fingers close around the canister. How far away would the gas work? Not at the distance of a sword, but there was no alternative. Chris took a deep breath and sprayed the gas. Dekir coughed and stepped forward.
You asshole, for that I'm going to cut you open and let you watch your guts spill out.
He swung upward, but Chris dodged it easily, and he thought it had some effect. Dekir swung again. Chris dodged, but the blade sliced his arm above the right elbow. Blood dripped from the wound. The canister fell from his hand. Dekir grinned. Chris stepped back, and this time felt his foot against a basin on the floor. It wasn't one of the powder basins. It was a heavy paste. He recognized it immediately. The basin at his feet was filled with automatic fire. Quickly, Chris bent over, lifted the basin, and threw it at Dekir. It struck him in the chest, the brown paste spattering his face and arms and body. Dekir snarled. Chris needed water. He looked around, desperate. Dekir smiled. No water? Too bad. Chris looked at the blood dripping from his wound. He realized in a detached way that he was finished. He watched Dekir approach slowly, confidently. He could smell Dekir's breath. He was close enough to spit on him.
Spit on him?
In the instant that he thought it, Chris spat on Dekir, not on the face, but in the chest. Wherever the spittle touched the paste, it began to smoke and hiss. Dekir looked down, horrified. The hissing was louder. In a moment, Dekir would burst into flames. Then Chris ran, as hard and as fast as he could. He ran. At the middle gate, the others saw him running. He was shouting, "Go! Go!" Marek looked back and saw flames begin to leap up inside the arsenal. "Move!" He pushed the others through the gate and into the next courtyard. Chris came running, and Marek grabbed his arm, pulling him to cover, just as the arsenal exploded. Soldiers and tents and horses were knocked flat by the shockwave. There was smoke and confusion everywhere. The professor said, "Let's go," and they ran straight across the courtyard. The final gatehouse was directly ahead. 2 minutes, 22 seconds. In the control room, there were screams and cheers. Kramer was jumping up and down. Gordon was pounding Stern on the back. The monitor was showing field fluctuations again, intense and powerful. "They're coming home," Kramer yelled. The remaining tanks were still being filled, though the water level was nearing the top. "How much time?" Stern said.
2 minutes 20.
"How long to fill the tanks?"
2 minutes 10.
"We going to make it?"
"You bet your ass we are," Gordon said.
Stern turned back to the field fluctuations. The unstable mountain peak was now stable, protruding above the surface, taking form. "How many are coming back?" But he already knew the answer, because the mountain peak was dividing into separate ridges. 3, the technician said. "Looks like 3 coming back." 1 minute, 44 seconds. The outermost gatehouse was closed. The portcullis was down, and the drawbridge had been raised. "How do we get it open?" Chris said. Marek was looking at the chains, seeing that they ran into the gatehouse itself. "Up there," he said, pointing above. There was a winch mechanism on the second floor. "You stay here, I'll do it."
"Come right back," Kate said.
"I will."
Hobbling up a spiral staircase, Marek came into a small stone room dominated by the iron winch that raised the drawbridge. Here he saw an elderly man, white-haired, shaking with fear as he held an iron bar in the links of the chain. The iron bar was keeping the drawbridge closed. Marek shoved him aside and pulled the bar free. The chain rattled. The drawbridge began to lower. He looked at his wrist counter and was startled to see that it said 1 minute 19 seconds.
"Andre,"
he heard Chris in his earpiece, "come on." Marek turned to go. Then he heard running feet and realized that there were soldiers on the roof of the guardhouse, coming down to see why the drawbridge was being lowered. If he left the room now, they would immediately stop the drawbridge from lowering any further. Marek knew what this meant. He had to stay longer. On the ground floor below, Chris watched the drawbridge as it lowered, chains clanking.
"Andre, come on!"
"There's soldiers. I have to guard the chain."
"What do you mean?"
Marek didn't answer. Chris heard a grunt and a scream of pain. Marek was up there fighting. Standing by the staircase leading down from the roof, Marek held his sword high. He killed the first soldier as he came out. He killed the second one, too, kicking the bodies as they fell, keeping the floor clear. The drawbridge continued down.
Andre, come on!
Looking out the window, he saw the others had not waited until the drawbridge was entirely down. They jumped out onto the field beyond the castle. Another soldier came down the stairs and Marek swung his sword. The man hastily backed up again, shouting and pushing the others.
Andre, run for it, Chris said. You have time!
Marek knew that was true. He could just make it. As he turned to go down the stairs, his glance fell on the old man, still cowering in the corner. Marek wondered what it must be like to live your entire life in this world, to live and love constantly on the edge, with disease and starvation and death and killing, to be alive in this world.
Andre, are you coming?
There's no time, Marek said.
Andre!
He looked out on the plain and saw successive flashes of light. The machines were there. They were all standing on their platforms. Kate said,
Andre, come on!
There was a short silence. Then,
I'm not leaving. I'm staying here, Andre said.
Andre, you're not thinking right.
Yes, I am.
Kate looked at the professor. He just nodded slowly.
All his life, he's wanted this.
Chris put the ceramic marker in the slot at his feet. Marek watched from the window of the gatehouse.
Hey, Andre.
See you, Chris.
Take care of yourself. Andre.
It was Kate.
I don't know what to say.
Goodbye, Kate.
Then he heard the professor say,
Goodbye, Andre.
Through his headset, he heard a recorded voice say,
Stand still, eyes open, deep breath, hold it, now.
On the plain, he saw a brilliant flash of light. Then there was another, and another, diminishing in intensity, until there was nothing more. Doniger strode back and forth across the stage. In the auditorium, the three corporate executives sat watching him. Sooner or later, he said, the artifice of entertainment will drive people to seek authenticity. What will people do? They are already doing it. The fastest growing segment of travel today is cultural tourism, people who want to immerse themselves in medieval walled cities, in vast Buddhist temples, people who want to walk in the vanished world. And they want it to be authentic. Who will guarantee that authenticity? Who will become the brand name of the past? ITC. I am about to show you our plans for cultural tourism sites around the world. In every case, we turn over the site to the government, but we own the surrounding territory, which means we will own the hotels and restaurants and shops. Tourists will spend $10 admission to get into the site, but they'll spend $500 in living expenses outside it. All that will be controlled by us. We estimate that each site will generate in excess of $2 billion a year, including merchandising. That is one reason for making your commitment to us. The other reason is more important. Under the guise of tourism, we are in effect building an intellectual brand name. History is the most powerful intellectual tool the society possesses. It tells us why the things we value are the things we should value, and it tells us what is to be ignored. That is true power, profound power, the power to define a whole society. The future lies in the past, in whoever controls the past. Doniger strode off the stage.
This better be good, Doniger said. I don't like to cut a session like that short.
It's important, Gordon said.
They were walking down the corridor toward the machine room. They're back?
Yes.
When?
About 15 minutes ago.
And?
One of them is pretty badly injured. The other two are okay.
So what's the problem? They went through a door.
They want to know why they weren't told ITC's plans.
Because it's none of their business.
They risk their lives.
They volunteered.
But they... Oh, fuck them. Who cares? They're a bunch of historians. They're all going to be out of a job anyway, unless they work for me.
Gordon didn't answer. He was looking over Doniger's shoulder. Doniger turned. Johnston was standing there, and the girl and one of the men. They were all covered in blood. They were standing by a video monitor which showed the auditorium. They must have heard the speech, or at least part of it.
Well, Doniger said, suddenly smiling, I'm very glad you're back.
No one spoke. They just stared at him.
Oh, the hell with you people, he said.
He turned to Gordon.
Why did you bring me here?
Gordon was holding a small gas cylinder in his hand.
There have been some discussions, Bob. We think someone more moderate should run the company.
There was a hiss. Doniger smelled a sharp odor, like ether. He awoke, hearing a loud humming sound. He was inside the machine. He saw the transit room rise up around him as he shrank, then the hissing foam, then the final shriek. Blackness. He heard the chirp of birds and opened his eyes. Where the hell was he? He got out of the machine and walked down the slope. He came to a break in the trees and looked down over a fortified town. It was partially obscured by the smoke of many fires, but he recognized it at once. Oh, hell, he thought. It's just Castelgard. What was the big deal forcing him to come here? It was Gordon, of course, who was behind it. The son of a bitch had been running the technology, and now he thought he could run the company as well. Gordon had sent him back, thinking he couldn't return. But Doniger could return, and he would, because he carried a ceramic with him at all times. He kept it in a slot in the heel of his shoe. He pulled the shoe off. Yes, the ceramic was there, but it was pushed deep in the slot, and it seemed to be stuck. He tried a twig, poking in the slot, but the twig bent. Next, he tried to pull the heel off the shoe, but he couldn't get enough leverage. What he needed was a metal tool of some kind, a wedge or a chisel. He could find one in the town. He put the shoe back on and walked down the slope. He was just above the east gate in the town wall, but the gate was wide open, and there were no soldiers along the walls. He looked at the fields and saw no one tending them. What the hell? He thought. He passed through the gate. He saw that the gate was unguarded because the soldier on guard lay dead on his back. Doniger leaned over to look at him. There were bright streaks of blood coming from around his eyes. And he heard the drum. He felt a chill. Doniger gave a low moan and backed away until his back touched something wooden. He turned and saw a wooden horse cart. He saw bundles of cloth piled high on the cart. Then he saw a child's foot protrude from one of the bundles, a woman's arm from another. Doniger began to shiver. The arm had odd, blackish lumps on it. The Black Death. He knew now what year it was. It was 1348, the year the plague first struck Castelgard and killed a third of the population, and he knew how it spread. Just breathing the air could kill you. People just fell over in the street. One minute you were perfectly fine, then the coughing began. An hour later you were dead. Doniger slumped down against a wall, feeling the numbness of terror creep over him. As he sat there, he began to cough. Rain slashed across the gray English landscape. The windshield wipers snicked back and forth. In the driver's seat, Edward Johnston said,
Elsie, are you sure this is the road?
Absolutely, Elsie Kastner said. It should be up there on the right.
I don't see anything, Chris said from the back seat.
Kate said, Is the air conditioner on? I'm hot. She was 7 months pregnant, and always hot.
Yes, it's on, Johnston said.
Chris patted her knee reassuringly. Johnston drove slowly. The rain diminished, and then Elsie said, There! On the top of the hill was a dark rectangle with crumbling walls.
That's it?
That's Eltham Castle, what's left of it. Johnston pulled the car to the side of the road.
Elsie read from her guidebook. First built on this site in the 11th century with later additions, notably the ruined keep from the 12th century and a chapel from the 14th. The rain lessened, now just scattered drops. Johnston got out. Elsie got out on the passenger side, her documents encased in plastic. Chris ran around the car to open the door for Kate and help her out. They began climbing up toward the castle. They saw no signs, nothing to indicate what this place had been, or even its name. Walking around a high wall, they saw the chapel, surprisingly complete, its roof rebuilt at some time in the past. Inside the chapel, Johnston took out a flashlight. Chris said, "How did you find out about this place, Elsie?" "In the documents, of course. There was a reference to a wealthy English brigand named Andrew de Eltham, who had paid a visit to the monastery of Saint-Mire in his later years. He brought his entire family from England, including his wife and grown sons. That started me searching."
"Here," Johnston said, shining his light on the floor. They walked over to see. A layer of damp leaves covered the floor.
Johnston was brushing them away to expose burial stones that had been set in the floor. Chris sucked in his breath when he saw the first one. It was a woman. The carving was unmistakably the Lady Claire. Claire was depicted with her eyes open, staring frankly at the viewer. "Still beautiful," Kate said.
"Yes," Johnston said. "Still beautiful."
Now the second stone was cleared away. Lying next to Claire, they saw Andre Marek. He, too, had his eyes open. Elsie said, "According to the documents, Andrew escorted Lady Claire back to England from France and then married her. By all accounts, they were inseparable and had 5 sons. Andrew's dying words were, 'I have chosen a good life.' He was buried in the family chapel in Eltham in June 1382. 1382, Chris said. He was 53. Johnston was cleaning the rest of the stone. They saw Marek's shield, a prancing English lion on a field of French lilies. Above the shield were words in Latin. Elsie said, "His family motto, echoing Richard Lionheart, appeared above the coat of arms. Companions whom I loved and still do love, tell them my song." Johnston touched the stone contours of Marek's face.
"Well, at least we know what happened."
"Do you think he meant it?" Chris said, pointing to the motto. "Do you think he was happy?"
"Yes," Johnston said.
But he was thinking that however much Marek loved it, it could never be his world. He must have always felt a foreigner there, because he had come from somewhere else. "I wonder if he ever missed us."
"Of course he did," the professor said. "Don't you miss him?"
Chris nodded. Kate sniffled and blew her nose.
"I do," Johnston said.
They went back outside. They walked down the hill to the car. By now the rain had entirely stopped, but the clouds remained dark and heavy. A note from the author. Our understanding of the medieval period has changed dramatically in the last 50 years. Although one occasionally still hears a self-important scientist speak of the Dark Ages, an age that was once thought to be static, brutal is now understood as dynamic, where violence, though commonplace, was generally far less deadly than today. As for the old reputation of medieval times as a dark time of parochialism, religious prejudice and mass slaughter, the record of the 20th century must lead any thoughtful observer to conclude that we are in no way superior. In fact, the conception of a brutal medieval period was an invention of the Renaissance, whose proponents were at pains to emphasize a new spirit, even at the expense of the facts. A word about time travel. While it is true that quantum teleportation has been demonstrated in laboratories around the world, the practical application of such phenomena lies in the future.
The ideas presented in this audiobook were stimulated by speculations of David Deutsch, Kip Thorne, Paul Nahon, and Charles Bennett, among others. What appears here may amuse them, but they would not take it seriously. This is a novel. Time travel rests firmly in the realm of fantasy. But the representation of the medieval world has a more substantial basis, and for it I am indebted to the work of many scholars. Errors are mine, not theirs.
Among the many other titles by Michael Crichton available on audio from Random House are Airframe, read by Blair Brown, The Lost World, read by Anthony Heald, Jurassic Park, read by John Hurd, Sphere, read by Edward Asner, and Disclosure, read by John Lithgow. This has been a Random House audio books presentation. Production copyright 1999, Random House, Inc., all rights reserved.